The last-minute wrangling over the budget in Washington is a worry to officials at federal science agencies like NASA and the National Institutes of Health. They're trying to figure out what a government shutdown would mean for the thousands of researchers who work for the government. It looks like lab animals will get fed and some types of scientific work will continue, but many studies will have to be stopped or put on hold. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, it's not just scientists who are worried.
Catherine Calhoun lives in Louisiana, and she's been paying close attention to news about a possible government shutdown. That's because her 8-year-old son, Billy, has a rare and painful bone disease that requires complicated treatments.
And there's really only one doctor in the whole world who can sort of put all the pieces together, and that doctor is at the National Institutes of Health.
Calhoun says her son is scheduled for his first appointment with him in June, but he's told her that during a shutdown, the NIH Clinical Center can't admit any new patients. Calhoun worries that even a brief shutdown could still cause problems and delays, since her son's visit will involve multiple tests and specialists.
Some of them only, can only see him on certain days, like only on a Wednesday or only on a Thursday. So I am worried that even if there's just a few weeks delay, it's going to kind of push the whole schedule back.
The NIH Clinical Center is the world's largest hospital dedicated totally to clinical research. Calhoun says it is hugely important for very sick people, and the prospect of a shutdown has been stressful for them and their doctors.
They want to help these patients, these real live people.
In addition to not taking new patients, the NIH Center would not start any new clinical trials if a shutdown happens. 7 new trials are supposed to start next week. 2 of them are for children with cancer. Other science agencies would also stop everything but the bare essentials. An official with the Department of Health and Human Services says childhood vaccine programs would continue, but having limited staff at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention could make it slower to recognize disease outbreaks. At the Environmental Protection Agency, an official says radiation monitoring in the wake of Japan's nuclear disaster would go on, but health assessments of chemicals would stop. Out in space, NASA satellites would be okay, including the famous Hubble Space Telescope. Catherine Trinidad is a spokesperson for NASA.
We're going to have small core teams that will continue working on those flights and missions to ensure the satellites are protected and that data continues to be collected.
And Houston's mission control will still answer calls from astronauts on the space station. But workers would have to stop prepping Endeavour, the next space shuttle scheduled to fly.
The launch date right now is April 29th, and if there is a short furlough, we don't anticipate any impact to that launch date.
If a furlough stretched on, that could mean delays as NASA tries to fly its last 2 missions and retire its aging shuttles. Many scientists around the country don't work directly for the government, but get grants from agencies like the National Science Foundation. A shutdown could interfere with awarding those grants. That happened back in 1995, when a shutdown lasted for weeks. Al Tyke is a science policy expert at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He remembers that shutdown.
It was not a total disaster. We didn't abandon scientific experiments in the middle, to my knowledge, and we didn't lose years and years of results.
But he says it was a waste of time and money, as scientists struggled to figure out what they were permitted to do, and then later had to come back and play catch-up. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
The U.S. economy continues to show signs of strength. New figures show Americans spent more on retail goods in the first quarter compared to last year. That's despite higher gas prices and bad weather and a late Easter holiday. NPR's Sonari Glinton has more.
I'm wearing a new pair of jeans. They're hot. It took me a long time to find them. I'm not the only one.
What the recession did was create the consumer to now be more selective with where they're going to shop.
Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst. He says consumers have suffered from what he calls frugal fatigue.
We're tired of being so frugal that we're only spending at the least expensive place.
A bunch of retailers released their first quarter numbers this week. High-end fancy stores like Saks Fifth Avenue, Bergdorf Goodman, Neiman Marcus, and Nordstrom all made money. But The Gap, which owns The Gap, Old Navy, and Banana Republic, was down 10%. Marshall Cohen says people are getting pickier about where they spend their money.
I call it distinctive conformity. The consumer today is very focused on buying product that does not make them one of a million, but rather one in a million.
Cohen says a customer might buy one pair of fancy jeans that no one else has and then go out and buy underwear, socks, shirts, stuff no one can see from a discount retailer. Come on, who would do that? Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
The State Department issues its annual Human Rights Report today. One focus will be the U.S. effort to keep the Internet open and available for people around the world. Activists throughout the Arab world have used Facebook and Twitter to organize protests, so many governments there have been trying to crack down on social media. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on the State Department's response.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has described the Internet as the modern-day town square, and her point person on human rights and democracy, Michael Posner, says he's working on ways to keep that space open.
This is sort of a cat-and-mouse game, and governments are constantly developing new techniques to go after critics, to go after dissenters. We're trying to stay ahead of the curve and trying to basically provide both technology, training, and diplomatic support to allow people to freely express their views.
Posner says the State Department has trained about 5,000 activists on new technology and spent $22 million on ways to help them get around government firewalls in places like China and Iran. The department is finalizing plans to spend another $28 million on new technology to protect websites from denial of service attacks, ensure privacy in text messages, and help out activists like those in Syria who are being rounded up by authorities.
When somebody gets arrested in Syria, there have been hundreds of arrests, the government grabs the phone and looks at your list of contacts. So one of the things we're doing is working with some young technology types to figure out how do you erase the list before they get their hands on it, a kind of a panic button.
Esra Abdel Fattah didn't have that when she was detained in Egypt 3 years ago. Known as the Facebook Girl, she is co-founder of the April 6 movement, one of the groups that organized protests that toppled Hosni Mubarak's regime. Abdel Fattah was here in Washington this week and told NPR that she's still pushing to keep the Internet open in her country as one way to ensure that the revolution stays on track.
We need to continue using these tools for campaigning, for propaganda, for reaching people, for discussions with people in a very fast way.
She's not only trying to communicate with Egyptians, but says she's often on Facebook and Twitter to exchange views with other activists in the region.
And then now we have connections with people from Yemen and from Bahrain, Syria, and we try to exchange experience between each other.
In an interview in the office of Human Rights First, the organization that hosted her here, Abdel Fattah said she's been seeking some advice. She's hoping to form a political party in Egypt and possibly run for parliament. The main way the U.S. can help, she says, is to insist on the rule of law, including in the field of communications. Assistant Secretary of State Posner discussed that with her this week.
The fact is the government shut down the Internet in 24 hours. So one of the things we talked about is, can you, as a matter of state policy, start to allow more Internet providers direct access into the country so it becomes more difficult for a future government to shut things down?
He says he's both optimistic and somewhat anxious about Egypt these days. And more broadly, he's worried that many governments around the world are obsessed with control, spending millions of dollars on technology to crack down on dissent. The assistant secretary says he thinks his job is to make sure activists can get the technology they need to protect themselves and to fight back. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
People may be buying more, but it's worth remembering that millions of Americans are still out of work. And even so, many employers say they can't find the people they need. So companies are encouraging their own workers to keep a lookout for talent. And workers can earn cash bonuses if someone they refer gets hired. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
You'll find employee referral programs in all kinds of industries, from technology to finance, manufacturing to healthcare.
We've had great success with it.
Jennifer Richards heads up human resources at the Virginia Mason Medical Center, one of Seattle's major healthcare providers.
In the last 2 years, we brought in quite a few staff members, particularly nurses, medical assistants, patient care techs, as well as some other non-clinical positions, IS, management, and so on.
Everything going all right? Just checking in to see if you need anything. Okay.
Purva Virgenkar is a recent hire. A few months ago, she contacted a fellow University of Michigan alum who works at the medical center.
It was a very generic email saying, hi, I'd like to just speak with you if you have some time. And
Virgenkar wasn't really looking for a job, just information, when she emailed Jolyn Succo, who oversees some performance improvement programs here. The two women didn't know each other, but Succo says they hit it off instantly.
We probably talked a good hour. Yeah, and quite frankly, she just asked wonderful questions of me, and I appreciated that she wanted to know about the organization and the culture because, you know, every organization has a different culture, and not every culture is for everybody.
And Succo says the longer they chatted, the more she thought,
this is somebody that we should really look at and talk to more.
So she referred Virgenkar to the hiring managers. Her motivation, she says, wasn't money. In fact, she'd forgotten about her employer's referral bonuses, which range from $700 to $2,000. Rather, Succo had a feeling, reinforced by a phone call to someone they had both worked with, that this was someone who would be an asset to the organization. Mary Prunke is a nurse and a recruiting supervisor here.
I think one of the things that we get by bringing on board somebody that's known by one of our staff members is we've already begun to establish an element of trust.
Employers feel like they know more about the person they're about to hire, and new employees who've been referred likely feel more comfortable too. When Purva Virgenkar came on board, for example, she felt like she already had an ally.
The very first day when I was taught to log how to log into my email, I already had an email from Jolyn saying, welcome. We're so happy that you're here, and let me know how I can help you in any way, and let's get coffee.
It's no secret that when new employees feel connected to an organization, they often perform better, and the employee who made the referral feels good too, because someone valued their opinion. Many of America's largest employers have referral programs. John Sullivan, a management professor at San Francisco State University, puts the figure at about 85% of Fortune 100 companies.
If your company's not doing a lot of hiring, it's critical that you get the right people for those few positions, and employee referrals just turns out to be the best method to do that.
Some observers worry that relying on employees to find talent can lead to a lack of diversity in the workplace. But Sullivan suggests a well-conceived recruiting program can avert that. Evidence suggests that referred employees often perform at very high levels, but there's yet another reason employers like these programs. They're cost-effective. The initial recruiting costs are lower, and because referred employees tend to stay longer, employers save money on future recruiting efforts. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.